plentiful.
Okay, honorable members. As the honorable Yenge walks to his seat, let me take this opportunity to welcome our visitors and presenters today. As you'll be aware, honorable members, we are today going to receive a number of presentations. The first three is around the credit rating services bill, and later on we'll be taking presentations on the financial markets bill. These are very, very important pieces of legislation before us, which are meant to contribute towards the stability of both the financial markets and the economy in general terms. We will take three presentations in a row and have discussions after that. I hope the presenters are here. The first presenters will be Moody's Investor Services. I guess the laptop is ready. This indicates to me that you should be the representative of that organization. And then we'll then take a presentation by Future Growth Asset Management, followed by Association of Savings and Investment South Africa, ASISA. Then we'll then take discussions simultaneously. We'll not take one and discuss. We'll allow you to complement each other and one another in the process. Thank you, honorable members. I think we should allow the presenters to lead us. You would introduce yourselves and indicate on how you intend to run your presentation. Thank you. Over to you.
Good morning, Chairman Nfumadi and members of the committee. I am Jean Kells. I am the General Manager in South Africa for Moody's Investors Service, and I'm joined today by my colleague Neil Akers, Vice President and Senior Regulatory Officer based in our London office. Moody's is the oldest bond rating agency in the world, and today Moody's Corporation, our parent company, is present in over 20 jurisdictions around the world, and we employ more than 6,000 people worldwide. Moody's has been present in South Africa for over 8 years through an office in Johannesburg, which currently employs 7 people, 4 of whom are analysts. On behalf of all my colleagues at Moody's, I thank the committee for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. At the outset, I will reference our role in capital markets before handing over to Neil to provide an overview of our comments on the Credit Rating Services Bill. Firstly, turning to the role of credit rating agencies in capital markets. Rating agencies occupy an important but narrow segment in the information industry. Our role is to disseminate opinions about the relative creditworthiness of, among other things, bonds issued by corporations, banks, governmental entities, as well as pools of assets collected in securitized or structured finance obligations. The heart of our service is expressing opinions on the relative credit risk of long-term fixed income debt instruments, which opinions are expressed on a 21-category rating scale ranging from AAA to single C. By making these opinions broadly and publicly available, rating agencies help to level the playing field between borrowers and lenders. More specifically, rating agencies serve the market by reducing information asymmetry between borrowers and lenders. Moving on to the second part of our submission about the Credit Rating Services Bill itself, we'll focus on our comments today on 5 areas of the bill, being independence of rating agencies, firstly, Secondly, proportionality. Thirdly, liability. Fourthly, we'll focus on third country issues, and lastly, on plain language provisions. I'll hand over to my colleague Neil Akers to address those, whereafter I will conclude our submission. Thank you.
Thank you, Jacques, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Firstly, the independence of rating agencies. A critical element that is common amongst most legislative initiatives for rating agencies is the importance of the independence of rating opinion. We therefore welcome the independence protection afforded to rating agencies under the bill. However, we have noted a number of areas where we believe the bill may be perceived to intrude on the independence of rating agencies and should, in our view, be deleted. For example, provisions pertaining to the form of disclosure of rating opinions and the design of rating methodologies and assumptions endanger the perception of our independence. A second important principle for the committee to consider is the proportionality of the resulting legislative framework. In order to avoid implementing regulation that imposes excessive costs and which stifles innovation and productivity, regulation needs to be proportionate, consistent, transparent, and targeted. Regulation also needs to be applied within the context that markets do not exist in isolation. A bill of this length and complexity that is inspired by standards in jurisdictions which are with a much larger rating agency industry is in our view disproportionate and will introduce significant barriers to entry. In totality, the bill will require compliance with the resulting act, rules, any directive, as well as a code of conduct, all with seemingly differing standards and principles, and with regulatory, civil, and criminal liability consequences for breaches thereof. It is noteworthy that no impact assessment was published together with the bill, but we believe that the extent of the proposed framework, unless simplified, will place South Africa as an outlier in terms of the extent of the regulatory requirements for rating agencies, especially in view of the industry's small scale in the country. Without the extensive application of the exemption provision in the bill, rating agencies may be forced to adopt different structures or business models, which may make conducting business in South Africa unsustainable. Thirdly, the bill proposes a new liability standard for rating agencies. Rating agencies are already subject to an extensive civil liability framework in South Africa, and introducing a regime which exposes rating agencies to liability for ratings that were somehow deemed wrong with the benefit of hindsight, would diminish the quality of ratings, because rating agencies, in response, might be inclined to assign more conservative ratings. The bill also seems to suggest that rating agencies should be prohibited from limiting or excluding their liability in dealings through contract. There may be certain circumstances where an outright exclusion of liability may be appropriate. For example, in the event of an issuer's associated fraud or criminality. Furthermore, the fact that rating agencies may not limit their liability appears to unduly invade private contractual terms between sophisticated parties. We also find particularly concerning the somewhat novel proposal to make any contravention of the resulting law a criminal offense. If the legislature introduces a specific liability regime for rating agencies, we believe that that regime should also recognize the need to protect rating agencies against an overly litigious framework by requiring all the elements of a dealing to be proven, and that only an intentional or gross negligent breach of the resulting law be considered as grounds for a claim in dealing. The legislation should also not interfere with contractual law. Turning to the fourth important section of the bill on scope and endorsements, Moody's welcomes the recognition of the need to have special regard to rating agencies that belong to multinational groups and that are regulated in third countries. The bill nevertheless creates overlapping regulatory responsibilities for rating agencies belonging to the same group. The risk of double regulation should be avoided, and Moody's would ask the committee to make this clear in the scope of the resulting act. Furthermore, Chapter 4 of the bill sets out a framework for rating agencies that are registered in South Africa to endorse credit ratings that are produced partly or wholly outside of South Africa. We note that outside of the European Union and Japan, no jurisdiction requires the endorsement of foreign credit ratings. Moody's would advocate a more efficient approach that gives some recognition to the supervisory work performed in third country jurisdictions. As reflected in our written submission to this committee, we would support an approach that permits the regulatory use in South Africa of credit ratings produced partly or wholly outside South Africa by external credit rating agencies, as defined in the bill. However, the registrar should be granted the power.
Do we have this document that you are?
You don't, but we can make it available after this, this discussion.
Yeah, you should have just indicated, because I can see members are struggling to follow your line of presentation in terms of the documentation before us.
Okay.
So it will be important that we get that document.
We certainly will do, Chair. Let me start sort of at the beginning of that paragraph. As reflected in our written submission, that we would support the approach that's followed, whereby the registrar would be granted the power to approve or decline regulatory use in whole or on an activity and an entity by entity basis. Finally, the plain language requirements in section 1, paragraph 5 of the bill could lead to confusion among market participants about how credit ratings should and should not be used. Plain language requirements in financial services regulation typically are associated with products and services intended for use by retail customers. However, credit ratings are used by market professionals. In our view, the proposed approach risks misleading the market as to the nature of a credit rating. It might also lead to an oversimplification of an otherwise complex analysis. A plain language requirement is also not standard international practice, and we therefore propose the deletion of this requirement, given that under Section 10(1)(b) of the bill, a rating agency is required to state clearly and prominently any attributes and limitation of the credit rating. I'll turn it now back to Jacques to conclude.
Thank you, Neil. Mr. Chair, in conclusion, Moody's is committed to the South African market. We've operated in this market for more than 8 years, and we see it as an important footprint into Africa and as a hub for ongoing credit rating activities. Let me be clear, Moody's supports the need for this bill. However, we are a business which needs to operate on an ongoing concern basis in South Africa, and therefore would ask Parliament to consider the merits of the extensive regulatory framework proposed in the bill in the light of the small industry in South Africa and to introduce a much simpler registration system for credit rating agencies in South Africa. As you will have read from the annex to our submission, we have proposed a number of amendments to the bill, which, although not referenced in our oral submission today, are of particular importance to us. Neil and I would be pleased to comment or clarify on any of these amendments or to take any questions from the committee. I thank you and the committee for your time. Thanks.
Thank you. As I indicated at the beginning, that we'll take all the three presentations and go into discussions. The second presentation is future growth. But I must say this last and the first presentation would really appreciate that we have your presentation clearly organized in such a way that we can be able to follow your argument and the propositions around which sections of the bill you would wish to be amended or to be deleted. Yeah, all right. Over to you. Yeah, good. We're in your hands. We are in your hands.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and honorable members, for the opportunity for us to present. My name is Olga Constantatos from Future Growth Asset Management. We represent the investor concerns or the investor comments around the credit ratings services bill. The agenda that I'm going to follow is really briefly to introduce Future Growth, just to give you some context to our submission, also to give you some background as to our thinking and our submissions and our proposals, really to contextualize the position that we have taken, to give you the necessary background information to deliberate. And then the summary of the key points, our detailed letter does have more comments than I'm going to talk through. I've really picked through the three main ones, and I'll go through those in detail and ask particular proposals and if there's a discussion after those, we would welcome those, and then I will conclude. Just to give an idea of Future Growth, if you don't already know, we are a fixed income asset manager. We manage people's pension funds at the end of the day. We are majority owned by Old Mutual. Staff own the rest of our equity. And we have got a variety of products and services. And really what this slide is looking at is just to show you that we specialize in credit and fixed income. We've got a variety of mandates from core bond, money market, to high yield and yield enhanced infrastructure type mandates. And we have over the years developed a specialty and an expertise in credit. We have an in-house credit team of credit analysts. And in addition to looking at the listed rated debt issuance that is out there, we also have quite a big book of unlisted and also unrated instruments. And so we feel we have some expertise in looking at credit. Currently, we have just over 111 billion assets under management. Approximately 70% of those are in credit assets, the rest are in government or government-guaranteed assets. This slide just gives you an idea of the various mandates, really from core bond, which is very vanilla, all the way down to much more high-yield type investments. We are users of credit ratings, and that is informing our submission. Some background to start off with, and this might be a little bit of finance 101, so apologies if I am, being a little bit basic. But what we really want to show here is that all debt is not created equal. A share, if you buy an MTN share, when you're an ordinary shareholder, you have the same rights as every other ordinary shareholder in MTN, as an example. But if you loan money to MTN, you could be a bank, you could be a pension fund like we are, loaning them money on the commercial paper market, and there are very different terms and conditions that attach to the various debt instruments that are out there. And what we're really looking to do here is we can show you, right at the bottom is equity. Equity gets paid last. Hybrids and prefs are next. Subordinated is next. And then senior unsecured debt is really the space that we tend to play in, and certainly that the rating agencies tend to opine on in terms of those instruments. But what you can see, if I just click through, the access to the cash flows and assets really starts from, you know, the seniority level down all the way down to equity. The equity shareholders get what's left at the end of the day. But even within the senior unsecured space, let me just do that, or in the senior space, you can also get senior secured, so then you have security over assets. You can get time subordination, effectively, where an instrument that matures next month will get access to the cash flows before an instrument that matures in a year's time. So what we're really looking to show you here is that debt is fragmented. Debt holders often have conflicting terms against each other, and it is non-standard. It's not like investing in a share. And what we've tended to find over time is that bank loans into corporates tend to have less defaults and higher recovery rates, and that's really because the banks tend to position themselves much higher along that continuum there in terms of getting access to specific security and also making sure that they are in line for those cash flows first. So really what the rating agencies are trying to do, and certainly what we try to do in looking at a particular bond, is we try to make sure, are we going to get our money back? We always keep in mind that the money that we manage is on behalf of pension funds, and the best we can do in a debt world is really to get our interest and to get our capital back. There's no, that is the upside that we're going to get. So in looking at managing these assets, we really look to try and protect the downside. So this slide really is just showing you our view that credit as an asset class is not going away, which makes this bill particularly important, and is, companies generally are under-geared. We've seen that there's a lot of, they're sitting with a lot of cash at the moment. You will have seen press reports around that recently as well. And so there is, there is a need potentially for more credit, and that makes this bill particularly timely. And so these submissions are, and these deliberations are particularly important. This comes back to the point that I made earlier, which in the debt world, we really like to say we live in a world of fear. We are fearful of not being repaid. We are fearful of inflation, for instance. The best we're ever going to do is if we loan somebody R1 million and we're getting a particular coupon back, we're going to be getting that interest back on a, say, annual basis. And at the end of, let's say, 4 years, with this example, we will get the coupon back. That is the best we're going to do. We really look to protect the repayments of those cash flows. So where is this all leading? It's really just some background to our submission. So if I just click through these. So this really just says the best we can do is get our money back, and talks about the world of fear, effectively, that we live in as debt investors. So if I move to our response, our letter has, as I mentioned earlier, a much more detailed submission in terms of specific points. There are three main sections that I would like to go through today. The first one really, well, before I do that, actually, I'd like to just show you the slide, and we use it quite a lot in our client presentations, and it's really to show the fiduciary responsibilities and the people who have fiduciary responsibilities over client money. And those are fund trustees, for instance, consultants, advisors, auditors, lawyers, asset managers, multi-managers, the regulators, etc. We are all on the side of the company or of the investor. We are looking out for their interests. And there's a line there that you can see. On the other side of the line really are the issuers, the project sponsors, the dealers. They don't really have any vested interest in making sure that the investors' money is protected. They're not acting in a fiduciary capacity. Most of the time they're really just generating fee income. And at the moment... Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. Click the wrong button. Okay, there we go. So there's two sides, effectively, of the fiduciary chain. And at the moment, the credit ratings agencies and the way the market works is that even though the work that they do is used by investors, there's no fiduciary accountability currently to investors. And our proposals really look to try and move the role of the credit ratings agents much more, you can see it moving up, much more into that of a role of a fiduciary. Investors effectively are the users of ratings, and we would just like to see more accountability to investors by the ratings agencies. So our first... Our first comment is around paragraph 3, which is around some registration exemptions which may be allowed by the regulator for holding companies that have or that operate in jurisdictions that may be regulated by another overseas regulator. We feel that the South African implication of that is that potentially 3 out of 4 could be exempt from providing information to the regulator and therefore to the investor base. So our concerns really are that the duty of care and accountability is to local investors. We feel that a high degree of transparency and comparability is needed, and we feel that would be compromised if effectively 75% of the rating agencies were allowed to not submit the same information as the local agencies. And we also feel that the purpose of this bill really is to allow for some local regulation and local jurisdiction. And we feel that the allowance for some exemptions for information doesn't necessarily allow for that. The second comment that we'd like to make, and it doesn't relate to a specific provision in the bill, but we would like some provisions included, really requiring some key individual accountability. And that this, again, is allied to the comment that we made around increasing the fiduciary responsibilities of rating agencies. As an example, in the asset management industry, we have the phase exams, which key individuals are required to complete, as well as portfolio managers, for instance, are required to have demonstrate some level of technical proficiency, as well as some knowledge of the regulations in terms of the exams that they have to take before they can actually manage money on behalf of clients. And we would like to see something similar in this bill that promotes this key individual accountability, which would potentially include the MD or CEO and the relevant analyst. And really, we believe that it promotes accountability, transparency, and moves the role of the rating agency much more into that of a fiduciary role. The third point that we'd like to make, and again, this isn't included in the current bill, but it is a provision that we would like included, is the lender's ability to replace a credit ratings agent. It is obviously quite controversial, and it is a suggestion that we are submitting. We have used it quite successfully in our unlisted debt transactions, so we have made it a provision in some of the loans that we have made, and it has had some success, we believe. If you think about the primary role of credit ratings agents, and I think Jacques mentioned it as well in his submission, is that the role really is to perform analysis for third party lenders, effectively for people to have some knowledge that there is another pair of eyes effectively looking at the entity and that they can loan money with some degree of safety. There is also the information asymmetry that Jacques mentioned, and what a rating agency can do is it can allow for non-material, non-public information in terms of a company not having to release material non-public information, but allowing a rating agency access to that information, and in that way the market being informed without having to necessarily go through a detailed material non-MNPI process. So we really feel that one of the roles of rating agencies is effectively a gatekeeper for issuers of public capital, but unfortunately we feel that the way the bill is currently drafted and the way that the market currently operates, the role is not enough of a fiduciary, and there isn't enough accountability to investors who are effectively the users of the ratings at the end of the day, which, I mean, let's not forget, it's people's pension money, which is what we always try and remember. So our proposal really is an analogy with auditors is actually a very good one. If you think of the role of an auditor, they are paid for by the company. Their role is, their output is effectively relied on by a variety of people, shareholders, regulators, banks, lenders, the man in the street really as well. And companies effectively, there's a layer of governance in appointing an auditor. There is a layer of governance, so usually what happens is the board of directors has to appoint auditors, they have to authorize the fees. And we think that creates a level of governance and accountability that users of that output can rely on. We would like to see something similar for credit ratings agents, where the issuer's audit committee, as an example, can approve or should approve the hiring, firing, or replacement of the credit ratings agents. We also feel that that potentially mitigates against rating shopping, which is a risk that if management of a company knows that they're about to be downgraded, maybe they cancel the arrangement that they have with the current rating agency and get a new one with maybe somebody who's a little bit more friendly. And the other thing that we have managed to include in a lot of our unlisted debt agreements is that a majority lender vote is needed to replace a credit ratings agent. What we tend to find is that makes the ratings agency much more accountable to investors. We found there are specific examples that we can cite where if there is news flow and information that is happening, if we call up the rating agents and they know that we have the ability to get rid of them at the end of the day if we don't feel they're performing their job, makes them much more responsive in terms of reacting to information. So it's potentially a little bit tricky, I think, with public debt issuance, but you could really have, you know, you could really have a majority vote of all listed owners of a particular debt voting for the replacement of a rating agency. So management would then have another layer of governance, and effectively it also, we feel that it supports the rating agency's independence. So if a company is perhaps putting a ratings agency under undue pressure, the fact that there is another layer of governance in terms of audit committee or potentially investors that have the say so as well, that effectively reinforces the rating agency's independence. So we feel the implications for these are fourfold. It really makes the rating agencies more accountable to investors. We think it improves accountability. We also think it includes an important layer of governance, and the analogy to the auditors we feel is an important one. And again, it improves the fiduciary role, which we see as very necessary. So in conclusion, the submission that we have made is really tied to those three points. The main aim is to improve the fiduciary role, really, so that investors can rely a great deal more on the output and on the opinions. We also feel that it improves transparency and accountability, which we believe is one of the aims of the bill. And we also think it goes some way to improving South African capital markets. But thank you for your time and for listening to me.
Thank you very much. Asisa? Welcome, Honorable Ambrosini. Are you ready? Okay, good. Over to you.
Good morning, honourable members and guests. My name is Audrey Messerschmidt. I'm a senior policy advisor at the Association for Savings and Investments South Africa, ASISA in short. What I will present today is an introduction to ASISA, the process we followed in collating comments to submit to this committee. Just one slide to indicate what is a credit rating, then a little bit more information on the ASISA perspective, and our opinion on Clause 4 of the bill. I must say before I start that I'm extremely nervous, so if I speak too fast or fall over my words, understand. It's quite an intimidating room, but also an honour to be here. ASISA was formed in October of 2008, and in that process, four different associations became one. Those were the Life Officers Association, the Linked Investment Service Providers Association, the Association for Collective Investments, and also the Investment Managers Association. So you'll see now, as a combined association, we represent the majority of life insurance companies, investment managers, collective investment scheme management companies, and linked investment services providers. The ASISA is mandated by its members to proactively engage with the policymaker and the regulator on policy, regulatory, and other issues of common concern. process we followed to make our submissions to National Treasury and this parliamentary committee was to create a working group. The working group was staffed by nominated representatives from members. We collated written comments from members which were discussed and considered by this working group before we finalized the submission. So this is the representative view of the majority of ASISA members. I must also include that Future Growth as part of the Old Mutual group is also a member of ASISA, but due to its specialist skills in the bond investment management environment, they added a separate submission with more detail. Just a recap. See there the nerves go. What is a credit rating? It's an assessment of the creditworthiness of companies and governments that issue debt, and it's based on the history of the borrowing and repayment, as well as the availability of assets and extent of liabilities. In other words, the likelihood of the default of the credit issuer. A poor credit rating indicates a credit rating agency's opinion that the company or government has a higher risk of defaulting, and also the opposite is true. CISA members considered this bill from an investor's perspective. Our members manage the assets of pension funds, collective investment schemes, medical schemes, corporate clients, and also has the fiduciary duty that Olga referred to. Investors have limited control over the choice of credit rating agencies, although the actions of the issuer and the credit rating agency may impact on the investments the investor owns. CISA members thus support the objects of the bill as set out in the memorandum. Even though reliance on credit ratings in legislation is being reduced, for example, it was removed from the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act recently. Previously, you could only include instruments that were rated by certain credit rating agencies and at certain levels. In line with international developments, those requirements have been removed. But even though it's not in legislation anymore, it is still, ASISA members still contract with clients in respect of exposure limits to credit rating bands. In an investment management agreement, the client agrees with the investment manager the credit exposure that they are willing to accept. And clients, investors, in other words, take comfort in that independent evaluation of credit exposure in their portfolios. Larger investment managers, such as Future Growth, employ expert resources to manage credit risk exposures. So they'll have processes and procedures in place similar to those applied by credit rating agencies to augment or sometimes they use the issued credit rating to augment their process. But smaller investment managers may not have access to those resources, and they may rely more heavily on credit ratings issued by credit rating agencies. From an investor's perspective, the higher the rating, the lower the perceived risk. And that's the information that's used in the process. From an investor's perspective still, if a credit rating is, for example, downgraded, it could result in forced selling. So if an investment manager agrees with its client to only have AAA rated debt in its portfolio and that AAA rating is downgraded, an investment manager will be forced to sell those investments and that may cause large losses. We therefore believe that the credit rating process must be sound to avoid the risk of inappropriate downgrading, as it may have adverse effects. It's imperative that the credit rating agencies are responsible and accountable. The integrity, transparency, and reliability of the credit rating process and credit ratings must be protected. I'll move on to Clause 4 of the Bill, which is our major concern from an interpretation perspective. The clause currently reads, a regulated person must, for regulatory purposes, only use credit ratings that are issued or endorsed by credit rating agencies which are registered in accordance with this Act. But these words may be misinterpreted to mean that any regulated entity, for example a pension fund, a collective investment scheme, or a life insurer, must only use credit ratings issued by a credit rating agency and no other ratings. We are concerned that the internal rating process that the larger investment managers employ will be excluded if the current wording are used, and we still believe that that's a valuable a value add to the client's management of their investments. We believe the intention was to require that where a regulated person is required in the applicable legislation to use credit ratings, that those ratings must be issued by a registered credit rating agency. I'll use pension funds for an example. The Regulation 28 of the Pension Funds Act, which determines the investments a pension fund may invest in, does not require the pension fund to always use credit ratings issued by a credit rating agency. It says that it can form part of the process, and that's where we are concerned that it may be misinterpreted. So we recommend that the obligation on regulated entities on how they should use credit ratings must reside in the primary legislation. So if there are rules for banks, it must be in the Banks Act. If there are rules for collective investment schemes, it must be in the Collective Investment Schemes Act to make sure that the provision is not misinterpreted. If the provision is retained, we suggest alternative wording to make it clear that where a person is required to use credit ratings for regulatory purposes, then those credit ratings need to be issued by a registered credit rating agency. ASISA and its members appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee and thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. Honorable members, we have, and I hope you have been able to note in each presentation the points that you wish to raise, points of clarity. Let me also take this opportunity to welcome our visitors in the gallery. I can see these are students coming to observe what parliamentarians do, and probably out of this interaction will inspire them to become future leaders of this country. Honorable Gordon Wolf, I've noted Gordon Wolf, Honorable Harris, followed by Honorable Ambrosini, Judith, Des Van Royen, and Honorable Ross. I hope you'll recall the order. Honorable Koranov.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's easy. I'm first. So that's to all three presenters. I want to know whether you've had any interaction before today with the Treasury one-on-one. So you can reply to that, you know, when you do get your chance. I hear there was a working group called by ASISA, but I just want to know whether you've had and whether, you know, whether there was progress during that. Then I want to ask Moody's, If this bill goes through in, like, published today, will Moody's think of leaving South Africa and go to Windhoek and create the hub from there for Africa? Is that a possibility? I want to know that. And then also to, maybe not to Moody's, I want to thank them for coming. But yo, I don't see Fitch or Standard & Poor or any others. Why are they not here? I think they should be here. And you should phone your colleagues, and probably not colleagues, competitors, but I think they should be here. I'm astonished that they're not in front of this committee. Then on future growth, what I'm getting is future growth big enough to have their own researchers? That was clearly said by ASISA. So in a sense, you are a credit rating agency, but you're not registered. And will you be registered in terms of this bill, being a CRA? I want to know that. If you're not, don't you think you are a little bit unfair by attacking the CRAs? Because when Future Growth is saying something to the market, I'm an investor, so I will listen to what Future Growth is saying. But you are completely unregulated. Is that fair for in this market? And then to ASISA. You say that the smaller investor don't have the ability like a Future Growth to have their own research teams. So they will look towards the credit rating agencies. So, but will they not also look towards Future Growth if they're smaller? Why do you say they will only look to the credit rating agencies? And the final questions to Moody's, how do you make your money? If you can just tell us that, how do you make your money?
Honorable Harris. Thanks, Chair. I'll start with the easy ones. I mean, I think from where I sit, the ASISA proposal is very, very simple, and I don't think anybody would disagree. It's simply clarifying a very early provision in the bill. I don't think it's controversial at all. Chair, for future growth, I'm interested, who on slide 13, I think it is, they talk about three of the four rating agencies would be exempt. Who are the four in South Africa? I think I can count three in my own head of the big ones. I presume there must be someone else operating that I'm not aware of. Secondly, this on the next slide, the story about key individual accountability. I mean, my understanding is that these rating agencies, especially the big ones, part of their governance model and part of the reason why it works so well is because it's global, and they kind of spread risk and accountability across the globe and get a diversity of opinions and actually formulate teams on an ad hoc basis to consider various accounts and various ratings. And I think that's probably good practice in the context of the world that we operate in. My concern about designating key individuals is that it's probably going to be impossible and would compromise that good practice in terms of their global spread currently. My initial impression of that is that it's unworkable and would probably increase risk. And then lastly, I'm perhaps confused by the arguments on slide 15 and 16 about the processes you're proposing. My understanding is that these are processes that you apply in your own internal operations. I don't see why we need to legislate it. Surely it's simply good practice on the part of issuers of debt. And it's your responsibility as issuers to either advise your clients in this regard or set up your structure so that your debt is managed in this way. I don't understand why we need to legislate for it. I'm talking about the proposals around the audit committee and the majority lender vote. Surely those are internal. then Chair on Moody's. I'd like to understand more about the alternative models for endorsement, particularly in other markets, and specifically smaller markets like us, where we are essentially taking the lead from other economies. Chair, I don't know if I see Advocate Jenkins is here. I'm not sure if he's in here in his official capacity as our legal advisor, but I would either now or at some stage in the future appreciate some advice on this provision. I think it was Moody's or one of the presenters spoke about the scope of, in the definitions, the definition of this act. It's on page 5 of the bill. And it defines this act to include all of the regulations, notes, and directives issued by Treasury. One of the presenters said that I think it was Moody's, that would effectively lead to circular arguments and is much too broad a definition of this act. If we can get an opinion, either now or later, from our advisors on whether that is standard and whether they agree with that concern from Moody's. And then a question on the plain language provision, which is on the same page 5 of the bill. I understand the concern from Moody's, but the provision specifies that it's plain language, meaning that a person of the class of persons for whom the credit rating is intended will understand it. I mean, surely then, when you say that the plain language provision will add elements of risk because credit ratings are intended for investment professionals, surely this specifies that it's plain language in terms of investment professionals. Then the code of conduct, again, if I could get a view on an international comparison, are there similar structures established in other markets? And what are the specific risks around the model that we've got on the table right now? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share the concern raised by both colleagues, and I will not repeat them, and I look forward to receiving the answers from the presenters. I did read the presentation from Moody and heard what has been said here today, and I'd like to the presenters, if they would, to help me out in getting beyond base one. I do have two concerns of principle before I move into the details of the bill. The first concern is that since for the past 35 years of studies, it has been inculcated in my mind that you cannot regulate the freedom of opinion. It's the most unregulatable part of human activities. An opinion is an opinion, and everyone has the freedom to express them up to the point of defamation. When there is defamation, then the law of defamation comes in. Here we are setting up a system to regulate who can express an opinion, how that opinion should be expressed. And I have difficulty of understanding the divide, the line between the regulation of form and the regulation of content. I know that there is no way we can go, constitutionally speaking, into the regulation of content of an opinion. That's our prohibited, the no-go area. But here we've got four levels of provisions: the law, the regulations, the directives, and the practice notes. All of them need to be abided to. And how do I satisfy myself that this bill is constitutional in giving such power to regulate an opinion? That's the first difficulty I have. The second difficulty is that this bill is all about accountability. And I accept that we are following an international model. It's been done in other countries. But these are precedents. Perhaps we should not follow everything that is done elsewhere. If I were looking at that accountability with a fresh mind, There are people who are getting an opinion. At times they get it wrong, at times they get it right. They should be held accountable when they get it wrong in a negligent manner. We are looking at the mechanism of accountability in point of how they go about doing their work, how they're staffed, how they're regulated, how they are, the competence of the people, not in terms of outcome. I'd like to put to the presenters how they would react to a system in terms of which they are required to constantly publish and disclose all the times they got it wrong. In AIG filed for bankruptcy while enjoying a AAA rating, I think, from Moody and S&P. And I think the situation with Salomon Brothers was similar. So if the public relies on these opinions and we are creating for them a virtual monopoly or cartels, because all those who are not so registered cannot give those opinions, it becomes illegal for Mr. Kornoff and I to set up a business in which we give opinions on solvability of companies, then why should they not be held accountable for cases of negligence, both in terms of disclosing when they got it wrong, and possibly be exposed to be sued for damages by those adversely affected by their negligence, as it happens for all other professionals. A lawyer is negligent, gets sued. A doctor is negligent, gets sued. But here, there are opinions sold under an extremely regulated environment, if this bill goes through, at a high price, and with legislation that we pass, forcing people to rely on them, exclusively or non-exclusively, depending how we go about this Article 4. So is the issue of liability for getting it wrong something that we should be concerned about? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Chavalala.
Let me start by welcoming the presentation. Probably mine will go to Moody's. As much as we are told that part of the credit rating role and responsibility, it's important because at some point it says that a poor credit rating indicates a credit rating agency opinion that the company or government has a higher risk of defaulting. And if such happens, therefore, this may cause large losses and so forth and so on. And on, just on that, I would want to find out, therefore, what becomes your obligation. But further, ASISA says to us that a credit rating process must therefore be sound to avoid risk of inappropriate downgrading. It further says imperative that credit rating agencies are responsible and are accountable. So to Moody around that opinion, what therefore becomes your response around that? Further, when you look into the bill says that a credit rating agency may be delinquent liable to an investor or a member of the public in respect of a credit rating issued or credit rating services performed in the ordinary course of business in terms of this act for any loss, damages, or cost sustained as a result of such credit rating or credit rating services. So to yourself, Moody, I want to find out around that. As much as you say, probably you don't agree about it, but I'm saying around the issues of accountability and taking responsibility around your ratings, what therefore becomes your response, rather than just saying that you don't agree with it, but what becomes a rather good measure for us to be able to deal with this. I want to also ask on Moody around the issues of the income. How do you therefore, how do you generate your income and sustain your company, take into account the type of work that you do. But I want to come to future growth. Future growth, in your slide 10, you speak about, you know, the issues of bonds and retirement funds. You say that, you know, your interest primarily is how do you get the money back? Your issue is that how do you get money back, bearing in mind that debt is is about fear, equity is about hope. But I want to find out, are you concerned about getting money back, realizing the fact that you're also dealing with the issues of pension fund? Are you concerned around getting it back in the form of a profit, or you just want to get the money back? Is it about servicing the economy or about just servicing the bottom line from where you are sitting? Also on future growth, you are speaking around your submission. You are speaking about, you know, lenders' ability to replace the credit rating agents. I want to find out, therefore, who becomes, because we are talking about lenders' ability to replace the audit committee approved and so forth and so on. But also now, who becomes around the third-party lenders? Who are they accountable to now? Because now, if they were to replace this one, who therefore? Because these are just lenders, are private people. So I would want to find out that therefore, who do they become accountable so to if we were to replace them with the CRAs? Just to elaborate your thoughts on that. Thank you so much, Chair.
Honourable Van Rijn, and the last one is going to be Honourable Ross, RR.
Hey, thank you very much, Chair. Maybe I must start by clarifying the apology that was presented in our first engagement when the bills were formally introduced to the committee. The apology presented by Standard & Poor, that they will make a written submission, but they won't be available for due to other commitments. But they were here when the bills were introduced formally to the committee, so they tendered that apology. Just to clear Honourable Coroner's concern. And Chair, mine is just one question. And said, I just wanted to be cleared by Moody's on their submission on the independence. At some stage, I was a bit confused. I thought it was contradictory to the commitment of that they have made in their presentation of being transparent. I will appreciate if you shed more light on what do you mean by saying the independence of rating agencies will be compromised by the form of disclosure on rating standards. Could you please shed some more light? Because I think from where I am, it's key, I mean, for the registrar to know or understand as to what are the methods or maybe what are the procedures that are employed, I mean, to come to this determination of the set standards. And I think that is very key, I mean, to determine the transparency of the rating agents. I will appreciate if I get some more clarity on that, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. For me, the CISA perspective is quite correct. It's imperative that credit rating agencies are responsible and accountable. You speak about integrity, transparency, and reliability of credit rating processes. And I think that's correct, sir. My problem comes in with the future growth presentation, where I find that when we speak about accountability and transparency, it's versus the independence. And I think we have to find out what balance we can find in this regard, because there's the other side to the coin as well. And that other side is when investor scare takes place and there's huge losses and there's that could be very negative for pension funds. And I understand your concern. And that's, I think, what you want is more responsibility from the credit rating agents. And somehow we in the Act need to address that as well. So although, you know, if we look at credit rating services bill and your individual accountability, to promote accountability and transparency, I find that we should respect the independence. But as I say, by being perhaps too independent, can, if there's bad news, can create problems in terms of losses and real losses for real people out there, and I think that's a concern, and we have to somehow just find that balance. The problem is not when there's good news. I think the problem is when there's bad news. And if the bad news somehow is mala fide, and I think that's where the problem comes in. And we have to, and perhaps then my question goes to Neil to say if it's, you know, to ensure that there's a bona fide approach always, that, you know, the public, myself, everybody, the pensioners, can know that, you know, the rating is bona fide and it's there to give the real information out. So we don't want to impede your independence, but somehow we have to find a balance in terms of responsibility that we don't get real losses out. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, honourable members. To our presenters, I think we'll allow you to take or to respond, starting with Modis. In that order.
Thank you, Chair.
And the questions may be cross-cutting. If questions have been responded to, you don't have to repeat yourself.
Thank you, Chair. We shall respond in the order that the questions were posed by the committee members. In response to the first question, did we meet with National Treasury? Yes, we have had the opportunity to meet one-on-one with the National Treasury on this bill. The second question, will Moody's leave if the goal, if this bill gets passed in its current form, would be set up shop in Windhoek, Namibia? I think the answer to that is, if the bill gets passed in its current form, we would have to relook at the business model in South Africa, given the requirements that the bill places on us as a business. Like I said in my submission, we've operated in this country for about 8.5 years, and I'm sincere when I say this is an important market for Moody's. You rate asset classes in the banking, corporate finance, the structured finance, as well as the regional and local government sector, and I think we have successfully built a critical mass in those sectors, so it is an important market for us, as much as the rest of Africa is becoming a key focus area for Moody's. If this bill gets passed in its current form, like I said, I think it is fair to say that we will have to relook our business model and the sustainability thereof. With regards to the comment regarding our competitors not having joined us today, I think two comments from Moody's perspective. Firstly, I regret not seeing more of them in the audience. I think it is an important industry. I think rating agencies play a vital role in the financial markets, and I certainly was hoping to see more support from them. Secondly, and just touching on that, I just want to make it clear today that whatever comments my colleague and I are making, we are not representing the industry. We are merely acting on behalf of Moody's Corporation in today's proceedings. Then the fourth question, how do we make our money? Before I answer that, and not to avoid the question, but perhaps to provide clarity, in the ratings world, there are two models in terms of how rating agencies make their money. The first is what is called the investor pay model, which is a scenario where investors would actually pay rating agencies to conduct and assign ratings to companies, banks, and bonds, for example. The second model is called the issuer pay model, and that's a model that is applied and has been applied in South Africa. And that is how we make our money, I think, directly via the issuer pay model. We have clients that approach us that want to go to the bond market or that seek credit rating for other purposes. Excuse me. They approach us and they pay us to assign credit ratings to the company. Moody's is a firm, if I maybe just may elaborate. We have two divisions. We have Moody's Investors Service, which is a rating agency, the entity that assigns the ratings. We have clients paying us all the way from governmental institutions, state-owned entities, corporations, banks that pay us to assign ratings on other entities themselves or on debt obligations. We also have a division called Moody's Analytics that sells subscriptions and access to that research. Just one other point I want to make regarding the payment and the way we operate. I think it's very important to point out that we have a clear delineation between the commercial side of the business and the analytical side of the business in order to manage and mitigate any potential or perceived conflict of interest. To this extent, no analyst that is involved in any rating activity is aware or is allowed to be aware of any commercial or fee discussion. And likewise, any person or party that is involved in a fee discussion with a client is not allowed to be part or privy of any rating committee where ratings are discussed or assigned. Perhaps I'll hand over to Neil to discuss the issues on endorsement, plain language, and the code of conduct, and I'll pick up again later. Thanks. Neil?
Thank you, Jacques, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and be brief, but of course, follow up as necessary. I think on the alternative model for endorsement, I think the proposal that we've put in place is, and it it's sort of very difficult in terms of how you look at the bill, but I think there is a provision already in the bill as it currently stands, which defines an external rating agency. And that definition would allow the registrar to make a determination as to whether that external rating agency, which is based offshore, is subject to regulatory requirements which are similar or as stringent as that in South Africa. So our view is, instead of introducing a specific endorsement requirement whereby we would have to endorse every single rating into South Africa for use by investors, our view is that if the registrar is comfortable that, for example, the Moody's entity in the US or the Moody's entity in the UK is subject to a regulatory framework that they are comfortable with, then we should be allowed, investors should be able to allow to use ratings that are assigned by that specific entity. If there is, for whatever reason, a breach of the regulation or whatever the case might be, the regulator can then take comfort in that foreign jurisdiction, that the regulator in that foreign jurisdiction will make sure that there is necessary enforcement action taken against that agency. And we think that's proportionate, given the number of ratings, for example, that are used in South Africa without introducing, I think, an overly burdensome requirement. Perhaps on the plain language, I agree fully in terms of the provision that does specifically state that if there is, that it is, the plain language should be directed at those for whom the rating is intended. Our full process, again, is saying that already the provision in the bill that requires us to speak in, to make our ratings very clear and accurate, is already there. We think the plain language is perhaps a bit of a red herring in terms of suggesting that there should be an alternative level of language that should be adopted down to the retail level. Whilst probably as a response to this requirement, we would have to state in our opinions that every opinion is directed to a financial market professional, and that's the way we would address probably this requirement. We think it's just unnecessary given the other provisions that are already contained within the Act. And finally, on the code of conduct, I think what we have here is typically a code of conduct, how it's constructed, and is adopted, I think, largely in terms of international codes of conduct which follow a comply or explain process. So a large part of the principles, and I think the reference in the bill to an international code of conduct, is to the IOSCO code of conduct, which is very much that, as a comply or explain code. So the principles, I think, are largely aspirational, and if there's non-compliance in certain areas, then there is a requirement for the rating agency to list those areas of non-compliance. It becomes very difficult when that type of aspirational language is then transcribed into a legislative standard, because it makes it very difficult to comply on an exact case-by-case basis if they're very high-level principles. So our argument is not against having a code of conduct. We just don't believe that the full raft of enforcement measures that would be available for a breach of the regulation should necessarily be applied to a code of conduct as well.
Moving on to Member Amrassini, the comment on accountability, I think I would maybe just a clarifying point and to support what the member has said, that I think we need to remain mindful of what we in fact put out in the market, our opinions. It also takes me to a comment that was made earlier, I think as part of the future growth presentation, just to clarify. I think we have always, it remains our view that we do not propose an over-reliance on ratings. We are fully aware that larger rating agents or larger investors have teams of credit analysts, smaller ones have smaller teams or none at all. But I think the fact of the matter remains that what we put out in the market is an opinion, and at a given point in time it is our opinion. And as you are probably aware, people tend to differ from one another's opinion. I think it's human nature. So the fact is that there should not be an over-reliance on ratings. Ratings can, and it's always been our position, that ratings should be used to the extent that investors feel comfortable. We're very mindful of the fact that it is ultimately pensioners' money, and one day I'm sure my pension money goes into those funds as well. So I'm cognizant of it. But it's an opinion and should not be overly relied on. Moving on to, I think, the member Shabalala regarding the comment on poor rating that poses a higher risk and may cause large losses I just want to point out, I think that was a comment that was made by the CISA. It's not a comment that came out of our presentation, so I can't stand further for that comment. Maybe just clarify that a higher rating, in our view, poses a relative higher credit quality in the case of an investor, or in the case of an issuer or a bond instrument. A lower rating, in our view, represents a lower relative credit risk. What becomes our obligations? I think it's important to draw two distinctions here. The first is, I think there are two types of losses that can occur. The first loss is when an investor actually suffers a loss because a bond which we rated ultimately defaults. Regardless of what our rating was at the time, and I'll ask Neil to comment perhaps on the liability that goes, or account level of accountability that should go with this, but the first type of loss is an investor loss on the back of a downgrade. The second loss, and again it's one of those which I think can be argued, and it comes out of the CISA proposal, is where a rating downgrade can potentially result in a loss, and I think it's important to draw the distinction. If an issuer defaults on a bond, it means it can no longer repay its debt obligations. It means either it cannot service the interest or the principal, or neither of those, and that's why it defaults. And like I said, hopefully our rating in time would affect that credit position. The second type of loss, in the case of a fire sale, let me perhaps give some context on that, I think just to highlight the difference. Many fixed income investor mandates actually have inclusion limits that run according to rating bands, saying if a bond is rated at a certain level, then a certain percentage of that might be included in a certain pension fund or a certain portfolio. If a rating or an issuer gets downgraded to a rating level which is below the minimum prescribed in that internal investor mandate, that would then force, in all likelihood, that investor or the portfolio manager to actually sell that asset or that instrument out of the specific portfolio. Now, I think on that, I think it needs to be understood that that is purely an internal requirement on the side of the investor. It's a decision based on their mandate, and granted that it is made on the basis of a rating, I'm not disputing that. But it is an internal decision that gets taken to sell the instrument. Given the fact that markets and prices move sometimes on credit ratings, and even on the level of trading and liquidity in certain instruments, pricing also might move. That is an instance where a portfolio manager or an investor might suffer a loss, given the fact that a rating has been downgraded. The distinction between this type of loss and the first type of loss, which I explained, is that in this case, the fact that a rating has been downgraded does not mean, in most instances, unless we downgraded it to default status, single C, in all other instances, it probably does still indicate, although a downgrade has taken place, that the issuer can still repay its interest and principal obligations. But merely that as a rating agency, we see the credit risk, or the perceived relative credit risk, of either the issuer or the instrument as being higher than what we had deemed it to be before. Neil, would you like to add anything there, responsibility?
Yeah, maybe just on liability, and I apologize.
Can I just indicate that the remaining period is not just for Moody's?
Yeah.
Because if you respond, I would have expected you to respond and your colleague to respond, and then we move over, not for interchanging amongst yourselves. Just make your comments.
Yeah, apologies, Chair. I think just on perhaps, and we'll close, then I'll try and link into Mr. Van Rijn's point on independence as well, to answer the question, and then we'll close with the liability. I think on independence is very important in the sense that I don't think we are arguing in terms of the process that the regulator can come in and make sure, for example, that the rating committee is duly established, that the disclosures are made according to the requirements of the regulation. I don't have any arguments against that whatsoever. Our concern was just in terms of the way the bill has been drafted in some of the provisions. The concern we had is that there's an ability, for example, for the regulator to publish rules on the methodologies or on the assumptions. And I think that's where we have the concern, or the presentation of the rating. We believe that because it's our opinion,
we need to have control over that opinion. It's very dangerous if, for example, it's any perception, and we don't suggest that the regulator will do this in South Africa, but if there's any perception internationally that the regulator is interposing themselves in our opinion, the concern is that is then seen as the regulator's opinion or the policymaker's opinion as opposed to the opinion of the rating agency. And if you take the example of just the sovereign debt, for example, that becomes more acute. Is where, for example, somebody looks at the rating on the national government on the specific debt that's issued. What's very important is that we are seen to be independent of the government that is issuing that debt, because otherwise it will just be seen as an issuer's determination as to what the creditworthiness is of that debt. So I think it's only on 2 points, and it's minor provisions where it's, I think it's more a language, and I certainly don't think it's the intention behind it, but perhaps could be adjusted, and it's further discussed in a written comment. And finally, Mr. Chair, with your patience, just one final point on the liability. Moody's, again, is not arguing that we should not be held liable and we shouldn't be subject to civil liability framework. That should certainly be the case. I think what we have a concern is that if it's linked, for example, a wrong rating or an incorrect rating, because what does that mean? You know, you could say, for example, that when we take any rating action, if we have a rating at, let's say, a triple N, we downgrade it to one level, does that mean the original rating was wrong? No, not necessarily. And if we had the same people in the room determining it on a different day, would that rating have come out at a different level? It may well have done. Again, it's something that is looking into the future in 10 years' time. Will that bond be likely to repay or not repay? And you can have different views on that. What's very important is that rating agencies follow their methodology, come to that methodology, and in the following of that procedure, they come out with an appropriate rating. But the ultimate rating result, to attach a liability standard to that, we would have significant concerns with.
Asisa?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, could I be indulged for a second? I thought it would probably be a good idea for me to introduce myself. I'm the fourth rating agency from Global Credit Ratings. We've been in South Africa for, we've been effectively operating in South Africa for 16 years. We're a local rating agency, so we focus on South Africa and the rest of the African market. And I would also just like to add that it's a bit disappointing to see that there are only two ratings.
Sorry, are you responding to the question?
No, I am indirectly. Just the question was asked if there was no other representation for the rating agencies, and that who was the fourth rating agency. So I'm just introducing myself as Melanie Brown. I'm the Managing Director of Global Credit Ratings, which is the fourth rating agency. We have made a submission, and it really just talks to Section 32 on liability, as well as the plain language clause as well. But I just thought it would be a good idea at this point, at this juncture, just introduce myself and say that we are here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Asisa.
Thank you. To start off with the interaction with National Treasury and the FSB, yes, we were consulted and we did have discussions on two occasions at least. And our written submission on the first draft bill was also considered by Treasury. The question on the smaller investment management company that may rely more heavily on credit ratings and why will they not look to future growth? And the reason for that is that they are also an asset manager and also have clients that they need to report to. So it will basically be their competitors. So a smaller operation in the investment management industry may not have huge access or the access to the amount of resources that someone like Future Growth would have, and they would rely more heavily on credit ratings, potentially. Just one thing on the responses on losses caused by downgrading or poor credit ratings. You will note in my presentation I did use the word inappropriate. Our concern is not that opinions will be changed. They should be changed if the information available requires them to be changed. We are concerned about the inappropriate changing, which may lead to client losses. And therefore the process. We are concerned that the process must be sound. The just one response on Honourable Ambrosini. I agree with you. It is an opinion, but it is an opinion that's relied on by ultimately the ordinary citizens of this country. And it is government's responsibility, I think, to protect the interests of those ordinary citizens of the country that rely on these opinions and where investment decisions are based upon them. I'm not saying there should be, you know, no regulation of opinion. I'm saying there should be appropriate regulation of opinion. I hope I haven't missed any questions.
Thank you. I'll address the questions also in order, hopefully. I just want to introduce my colleague Jason Lightfoot. He'll also step in if you feel I'm not answering it properly. In terms of the interaction with Treasury, no, we didn't have one-on-one. Us as Future Growth didn't have one-on-one interactions with Treasury on this matter. The second question, I think, from Member Kornhoff was, is Future Growth big enough to have our own research? And should we not then be regulated ourselves as a credit rating agency? As Asisa said, we really, how you need to think about us doing our research is effectively like an equity house. Equity houses do their own internal research and they come up with buy, sell, and hold decisions. So they'll opine, they'll, you know, do their models, they'll do whatever they need to do, and then they'll come up with, you know, MTN, for instance, as an example, is looking good as a buy at a particular price level. That's exactly the same thing that we do. The only difference is that we are not looking at equities, we are looking at fixed income instruments. So our own internal credit ratings are really internal buy, sell, and hold decisions. And what we try and do in making those assessments is making sure that the risk-adjusted return is appropriate. So, for instance, we are going to want a lot more money from... in giving a loan to a company that is newly established, that doesn't have a track record, that is perhaps small, as opposed to lending money to Rand Water Board, for instance. Two very different entities. And so it's just important to note that our own internal ratings are not for external consumption, they are for our own client funds only, and they really are investment decisions similar to an equity house around buy, sell, or hold. So if things are happening in a particular market, maybe we think... you know, pick an example, a particular industry is looking like we need to invest in a similar to what an equity manager would do, we would then look to buy instruments, debt instruments, in that particular industry sector. So the second point I think around that is around our regulations. Are we regulated? As an asset manager, we are subject to regulations. We're Pension Funds Act, there's a variety of regulations that we are subjected to, and our clients themselves, in terms of the way we manage their funds, there are regulations that are appropriate. So the credit ratings bill wouldn't apply to us because we are not a credit ratings agent, and it's important to note that our own research is our own internal investment decision-making. To the next question, I think it was Member Harris who asked about the rating agencies. I think Melanie has said that Global is the fourth one. In fact, I think there's actually five. There's Ratings Africa as well, which are fairly new. Again, operating in mainly in Southern Africa. And around the key individual accountability and the global ratings committees and the risk that introducing key individual accountability might prevent some of that global knowledge and opinion. I think what we're saying is that it's not... It doesn't preclude ratings committees that are staffed by overseas members. Key individual accountability really just says that there is somebody in a local context and in a local jurisdiction who is taking responsibility for the opinions issued by that corporate entity. And we understand the methodology, and we certainly wouldn't want to get rid of the international perspective and the international knowledge that the rating agencies do utilize in their global ratings committees. So we don't see the two as being necessarily mutually exclusive. I think the next question that Member Harris had was around the ability to replace credit ratings agents, and the question was, should it not be better to do this in terms of our internal processes and not in the legislation? What we've tended to find, and unfortunately it's because the market is fragmented, that the investor market is particularly fragmented, it's very difficult as an investor to insist on these terms when there are perhaps other investors who may not see them as necessarily being as important, or we may not necessarily see the potential value that they can add. So we do anyway do them in terms of our internal processes. I think really what this legislation is looking to do is looking to make sure that where public capital markets are used, that there is similar provision allowed, and it reinforces investors' ability to negotiate. It reinforces our ability to actually get these through. Unfortunately, what tends to happen is issuers come to market and they see a whole lot of investors at the same time. The deal is basically taken, you take it or leave it as it is. Whereas what we find on the unlisted debt side, there's much more ability to negotiate and work a solution that is a little bit more investor friendly. Unfortunately, the regime, and it's in other jurisdictions as well, tends to be very investor friendly light. So there's very few protections really for investors in public capital markets. And we really feel that the investor's ability to replace credit rating agencies, and it wouldn't be something that would be done particularly, you know, it wouldn't be done lightly. It would be a considered decision, and it would have to be a majority vote by all lenders. And there are, there are certain provisions in agreements that I can think of that anyway require a majority lender vote. In terms of, let's say, early repayment of a bond, that in some instances may need a majority lender vote, in which case it would be easy to replicate that for replacing credit rating agencies. I think that the problem is that relying on internal processes, there isn't that negotiating power, I think, that's available to us or to us as investors.
Yeah, maybe to add to that, I mean, the problem with the issuer pay model that Jacques alluded to is that the issuer pays. So, I mean, basically, they have the ability to either fire or replace the agency if a downgrade is imminent or if that might be the case. So, the onus lies on them. We want to put that power to the actual underlying investors. Basically, we are relying on those ratings at the end of the day.
Okay, then I think... Member Ambrosini, the issues around the concerns of principle around regulating freedom of opinion, I agree, it is tricky. I mean, you can't really, but I think if you liken the role of credit rating agencies much more to the role of auditors also issue an opinion on the financial health of a company. They are also required to be accountable to their users, and absolutely they do get it wrong some of the time, and they are reliant on management information to get there. But I think what we're really looking for is much more much more accountability really around the issuance of that opinion, so that opinion, when it does get issued, is not issued lightly. It is considered, and that there is a recognition of the parties who are using that information and making investment decisions on that. So it is an opinion, and we do know that, and it is what Jacques was saying around overly relying on the ratings. I don't think we are advocating for over-reliance, but I think in our opinion, particularly for the smaller investors, where they don't have teams of credit and to be able to look at something independently, there is a level of reliance, and I think it's important to note that there is a minimum level of reliance that is needed, and so the accountability is important.
Maybe to add to that, I mean, at the moment, primarily sophisticated investors play in this market, and possibly down the road sometime, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see individual investors on the street ultimately buying debt that's listed on the JSE. I mean, it's going to happen at some point in time. At the moment, there's about 1.2 trillion rand worth of debt listed on the JSE. And ultimately, you need to protect the guy on the road, on the street.
I think the next questions were around, Member Chabalala, around how do we get the money back in terms of a profit. Really, what we are looking to do is to make a risk-adjusted return. So if we are lending somebody R1 million, the rate of return that we require back from that depends on the risk that we see in that in that corporate. So we will require a much lower risk-adjusted return for instance, if I use an example of a water board, as we would for a new startup entity with very unstable cash flows or very uncertain cash flows. So the profit that is made, and it's important to bear in mind that we don't make this money for our individual account, it's for the funds that we manage. They effectively are getting a rate of return on their investment. And then I think the other question around the replacement and third-party lenders, and who are they accountable to? Effectively, we are acting for the lenders. We act for the funds that effectively lend the money. They are trustees of the various pension funds who put together in conjunction with us a mandate, and they agree the risk profile of that particular mandate. So it'll be different. You know, a fund of people about to retire has a very different risk profile to a fund of people who are young, starting off their careers. So there's very different risk mandates that are negotiated, and we as asset managers are effectively accountable to the trustees who appoint us, and effectively at the end of the day accountable to the members whose money we are managing. And then I think the other question was around the accountability and transparency versus the independence. The proposal that we made, we feel, actually supports the independence of the rating agencies in that it gives them a layer of governance, particularly around the audit committee, etc., that we propose. It inserts a layer of governance and removes the potential conflict that they are under, particularly as regards to management, who currently management of the issuer, who have the power to set their fees, to hire them, to fire them, to replace them as and when they feel the need. So we really do feel that the balance, we agree the balance is needed, and that the proposals that we make are aiming to reinforce that independence and effectively make the rating agency's job easier in terms of being able to issue a free opinion without being fettered by revenue concerns that maybe they're going to lose a particular mandate if they downgrade. I just want to reiterate, we do support the issuer pays model, that we're not advocating for moving to the investor pays model. And again, I think the example of the auditors is very apt in that the company pays the audit fee, but that outcome is relied on by a variety of parties. And we would like to see something similar in the ratings bill, where the issuer pays the ratings fee, but that there is much more accountability and reliance for users of those ratings.
Maybe just to add to that, I mean, we definitely support the growth of the industry, and by exempting the three big agencies from this regulation, it's definitely going to stifle growth. And that's my view.
Thank you. Zoban, want to say something?
Thank you. I think with respect to what Olga was saying, I think no rating agency takes or accords a rating lightly. Perhaps that's a better word, but when according a rating, you're looking at a number of factors. A lot of them are based on facts and historical information, but a lot is also based on what management provides you, as well as fundamentals driving the industry. So it could be economic, it could be political. So there's a lot of unknown factors when according a rating. So whenever a rating committee meets to accord a rating, it's taken by a committee. It's not taken by an individual person. And it's basically a collective of minds discussing where we think the economy is going, where we think the industry is going, how we feel legislation will be impacting on that industry going in, you know, moving into the future. So these are a lot of unknown factors that get taken into account, and none of them at a later point in time could be seen to have been incorrect. There were opinions taken at a point in time based on the facts that we had at our disposal. So I think from a rating agency's perspective, every rating that is accorded is a lot of work and a lot of analysis that goes into that. And no rating is ever taken lightly, especially for global credit ratings. And I say this because we're operating in this market and we're seen as a local rating agency. And I think there's somewhat of a stigma that goes to that. We do only have 16 years worth of track record, so we can't compare ourselves to an S&P or Moody's with 100 years of data. But we do understand this market. We understand developing markets very, very well. We understand the risks, and we know that the risks in developing markets are fundamentally different to those in developed markets. And, you know, ultimately, we have a lot more to lose because we don't have the Moody's and S&P brand when according that rating. So we could never survive an Enron, as an example. So we have to be specifically very, very careful when according that rating to make sure that whatever rating comes out into the market, there's very little, how should I put this? We have the brand. We have a much weaker or smaller brand to, protect in this market than international rating agencies. So I think a lot of care is taken when we accord those ratings. Almost self-regulated, if I could use that word. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, my sense is on both sides would want to have a second bite. And probably there are those from the side of the presenters that still feel they would have wanted to say more. But unfortunately, because of time constraints, would not have second round questions from the side of honourable members, but also not give you the second bite. Let me just also indicate that we have received your written submissions and oral submissions, and from the National Treasury point of view, we have had extensive interactions from the information that we have. Advocate Jenkins, there was an issue that I hope you've taken note of, raised by Honourable Tim Harris, in terms of some legislative issues. National Treasury is here also. But I just want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for taking your time and making preparations to come and share your ideas and views regarding this very, very important piece of legislation that we have to process. Quite important, but very, very intense and quite involved. So we will, in our consideration as a committee, take your presentation and your submissions very, very serious. Thank you very much. Whilst we are preparing for the, or setting up for the next presentation, can we take 5 to 10 minutes, or 5 to 7 minutes?